listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Today, I wanted to focus mainly on Judge Kavanaugh and the confirmation process and where we're at thus far. You may be aware on Friday, the Senate Judiciary Committee passed Judge Kavanaugh's nomination out of the committee on a 12-11, basically a partisan vote. Soon after that vote, Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, who I have to add that is not running for re-election, called for an FBI investigation that was limited in time and scope, basically set a week, limited to the allegations already made. And since Republicans have a razor-thin majority in the Senate, he basically bent the Senate to his will because Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, also a Republican, joined him. I believe Susan Collins of Maine is also on board. So they could hold a vote. They could hold a floor vote. But unfortunately, with these three senators peeled off, he wouldn't be able to be confirmed. So here we are. We're about several days into an FBI, another FBI background investigation. Mind you, a background investigation is different than a criminal investigation that the FBI would do. The FBI basically collects information. They interview witnesses. They do not come to a conclusion. That's up to the Senate. They also cannot subpoena anybody. They can't force anybody to talk to them. So they're limited in who's willing to talk to them and basically list the witnesses that they have. Also this week, Kate Snow of NBC News interviewed Julie Swetnick, Judge Kavanaugh's third accuser, and that had some interesting information as well. We'll get to that in a bit. But first, before we talk about all this, here's a word from our sponsor.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
So, the FBI is investigating. I wanted to read some excerpts out of an article I read in Bloomberg, written by Chris Strom. He writes, quote, "The FBI has been granted broader authority to investigate sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, but isn't doing its own dive deep into his alcohol use or whether he committed perjury when he testified last week, according to a person familiar with the matter." So that's something that we're seeing, that Democrats are moving off the sexual assault. Now they're trying to say, oh, he committed perjury. Oh, he was a drunkard in school, that, you know, he downplayed his alcohol use in high school and in college. We'll get into an altercation he had, later on. Going on, he said, writes, quote, "The White House agreed on Monday to let the Federal Bureau of Investigation question more people in connection with allegations that he was sexually abusive toward women, following growing criticism that the probe was too constrained. But the White House hasn't asked the FBI to do a full-throttle probe of Kavanaugh's use of alcohol or whether he intentionally gave false testimony to the Senate committee," the person said. So basically what we're seeing is that, this, they're trying to delay. And that's something that that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called them on.
Their goalposts keep shifting, but their goal hadn't moved an inch, not an inch. The goal's been the same all along. And so let me make it very clear. The time for endless delay and obstruction has come to a close. Judge Kavanaugh's nomination is out of committee. We're considering it here on the floor. And Mr. President, we'll be voting this week.
So there you have it. Senate Majority Mitch McConnell says that the Senate will be voting on his nominee, on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination this week. The week time span that was agreed upon would be ending on Friday. The Senate should be up for a vote. We're going to see if Democrats are going to try to delay this any further. And basically, we're looking at seeing what Senator Flake will do, what Senator Murkowski will do, what Senator Collins will do. Also looking to see if there will be any Democrats that will join Republicans in voting in favor of Judge Kavanaugh's nomination, barring, I guess, some bombshell, drop by the FBI. If they actually find something, you know, then it's a whole new ball game. President Trump actually said he believes the FBI investigation will end up being a good thing.
I want them to do a very comprehensive investigation, whatever that means, according to the senators and the Republicans and the Republican majority. I want them to do that. I want it to be comprehensive. I actually think it's a good thing for Judge Kavanaugh. I think it's actually a good thing, not a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. Now, with that being said, I'd like it to go quickly. And the reason I'd like it to go quickly, very simple. It's so simple. Because it's unfair to him at this point. What his wife is going through, what his beautiful children are going through, is not describable. It's not describable. It's not fair.
President Trump says finishing this off will make this process fair. Quickly, doing it quickly, that is. Will it be quick? That's the question, you know, that's on everybody's mind. Will this really end in a week? Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat out of New York, said that, yes, the FBI has a capability of doing an investigation within a week, but he wants to make sure it's a thorough investigation.
The FBI has ample resources to do this within the one-week period requested by the members of the Judiciary Committee. No one is asking it take longer than a week, but everyone is asking it be done thoroughly and completely within that week.
Some of Senator Schumer's colleagues are already calling this investigation a farce. Senator Mazie Hirono, a Hawaii Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, the New York Times reports, said on ABC's This Week that any investigation that limits who the FBI can interview and which leads agents can follow would be a farce. Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Minnesota Democrat, I probably still mispronounced her name, who was also on the committee, described what she said was micromanaging from the White House. You can't interview this person. You can't look at this time period. You can only look at these people from one side of the street from when they were growing up. I mean, come on, she said on CNN's State of the Union. Democrats were to some degree in the dark about the inquiry's parameters. In a letter to Donald F. McGahn II, the White House counsel, and Christopher A. Wray, the FBI director, the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, asked for a copy of the directive sent by the White House to the Bureau laying out the scope of the investigation. If the FBI requests any expansion beyond the initial directive, please provide the names of any additional witnesses or evidence, the Democrat Senator Dianne Feinstein of California wrote in the letter. It's not unusual for the White House to specify the scope of a request for additional background information on a nominee, New York Times continues. No evidence has emerged that the White House has forbidden any investigative steps, and President Trump has said that he wants agents to interview whomever they deem appropriate at their discretion, unquote. So, basically, I don't think the White House is trying to limit this investigation, but I think the Democrats are trying to smear it again, another, you know, delay tactic. Basically, these allegations are kind of on the ropes. David French had an article in National Review where he writes, the case against Kavanaugh is collapsing. He writes, quote, the day before the hearing, Michael Avenatti released a declaration by a client, a woman named Julie Swetnick, claiming that she saw Kavanaugh waiting his turn for gang rapes after facilitating them by spiking or drugging the punch at high school parties. She claimed that she went to multiple such parties and was gang raped at one of them, though she would only assert that Kavanaugh was present on that occasion. The claim against Kavanaugh was transparently absurd. The idea a person would repeatedly attend the gang rape parties, and that the existence of these parties, which would presumably generate multiple victims and bystander witnesses, remained utterly secret for decades, is nonsense. But left-wing Twitter took up the claims with the vengeful dragging anyone who dared express doubt through the mud. After all, didn't the Catholic Church scandals prove that crimes could be concealed? Didn't 16 Candles have a subplot about a drunk male geek sleeping with a drunk popular girl? Yes, that was an actual article in Vox. But then the Wall Street Journal did some actual reporting, contacting dozens of former classmates and colleagues, only to find it couldn't reach anyone with knowledge of Swetnick's allegations. Moreover, no friends have come forward to publicly support her claims. Again, she alleged repeated gang rapes, yet there are no other witnesses. And we're going to play some excerpts of the interview she did with NBC News here in a little while. So, also, the second he highlights the second accusation, quote, meanwhile, Deborah Ramirez's allegation that Kavanaugh exposed himself at a party at Yale remains essentially where it was last week, uncorroborated and difficult to believe. She was drinking heavily at the time. She confesses her memory contains gaps. She even told other classmates that she wasn't certain it was Kavanaugh. No one else could even confirm he was at the party where the incident allegedly occurred. No responsible journalistic outlet should have ever run the story, and that was The New Yorker. And without more evidence, no fair-minded person should believe it either. And which, basically, then he turns to the first accusation, Christine Blasey Ford. Yesterday, Arizona prosecutor Rachel Mitchell released a memorandum, which, by the way, you can also find at Caffeinated Thoughts, but going back to David French's piece. This memorandum was sent to all Republican senators, summarizing Ford's evidence against Kavanaugh. I'd urge you to read the entire thing. Democrats are describing it as a partisan document, but it refers to multiple undisputed facts that should cause even Ford's most zealous defenders to pause and reevaluate her claims. Ford has no corroborating witnesses, and even the friends she says she was at in the party in question has denied being there or knowing Kavanaugh at all. She doesn't know who invited her to the party, where it took place, how she got there, or how she got home after. By her account, Kavanaugh attacked her, but the problems go beyond gaps in memory. She has offered substantially different accounts about when the attack occurred. She previously said it happened in the mid-80s, in her late teens, and in the 80s. Now she's saying it happened in 1982, when she was 15, and how it occurred. Her therapist notes conflict with her story of the attack, and she's offered different accounts about who attended the party. All of these inconsistencies and omissions are important. None of them can help her case. For a brief moment after the hearing, Democrats believed that one of the Kavanaugh's calendar entries corroborated Ford's story. A July 1st, 1982 note that says, go to Timmy's for skis with Judge Tom P.J. Bernie Squee. According to the Democratic theory, because Ford testified that skis was short for brewskis, beer, and because Judge and PJ were allegedly at the party where Ford claimed she was assaulted, this could be the documentary evidence that the party took place. Interestingly, he writes, no Democratic senator explored this theory with Kavanaugh while he was testifying, and Ford's team never raised it either. It was left to be floated after Kavanaugh was off the stand, and now legions of Democrats are presenting it as corroboration. It's nothing of the sort, he writes. First and foremost, Timmy's house was 10 miles from the country club Ford had described as in proximity to the party, and it did not meet the description of the house that Ford offered in her testimony. Second, the lineup of attendees does not mention a single female and is substantially different from the one she has described. And finally, the lineup includes Squee, the nickname for Chris Garrett, a boy Ford was, according to her testimony, seeing at the time. It would be odd indeed to remember a party's attendees and forget that one of them was your then boyfriend. In other words, for the July 1st theory to be correct, Ford's previous testimony would have to be substantially incorrect. The theory is so thin that even a CNN analysis described it as circumstantial at best. So he's basically saying no responsible lawyer would bring us even a civil case on the facts described in her in her accusation. It doesn't even meet the standard of preponderance of evidence. There's no corroboration. I want to turn to an interesting article written by Sean Davis in The Federalist entitled "Kavanaugh Accuser Co-Authored Study Citing Use of Hypnosis to Retrieve Memories." He writes, quote, "Christine Blasey Ford, a California woman who has accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of attempted rape in the 1980s, co-authored an academic study that cited the use of hypnosis as a tool to retrieve memories in traumatized patients. The academic paper, entitled "Meditation with Yoga, Group Therapy with Hypnosis, and Psychoeducation for Long-Term Depressed Mood, a Randomized Plot Trial," described the results of a study that tested the efficacy of certain treatments on 46 depressed individuals. The study was published by the Journal of Clinical Psychology in May of 2008. While the paper by Ford and several other co-authors focused on whether various therapeutic techniques, including hypnosis, alleviate depression, it also discussed the therapeutic use of hypnosis to assist in the retrieval of important memories and to create artificial situations to assist in treatment. Ford's paper cited a controversial 1964 paper on the use of hypnosis to treat alcoholics and claimed that hypnosis could be used to improve rapport in the therapeutic relationship, assist in the retrieval of important memories, and create an artificial situations that would permit the client to express ego-dystonic emotions in a safe manner. The study by Ford and her co-authors also used self-hypnosis to help treat the randomized sample of patients, unquote. He goes further and he writes, quote, "The 2004 text by Spiegel and Spiegel, referenced by Ford and her fellow researchers, discuss in detail the use of hypnotism and even self-hypnotism to recover memories from traumatic episodes. Remember, all hypnosis is really self-hypnosis," the authors of the reference 2004 text on hypnotism wrote. "Therefore, therapists are only tapping into their patient's natural ability to enter a trance state." And, you know, this kind of begs the question. We really need to see these therapist notes. Because if this was something that she was, you know, gave validity to, it would be good to know whether or not this is something that her therapist attempted on her. Because, frankly, there's problems with this type of thing. And that, as the study showed, that, you know, memories can get confused, that it's not an effective means of remembering a traumatic situation. It's not proven. It's suspect. And I think we need to know whether or not Dr. Ford actually engaged in this with her therapist. As I mentioned earlier, Democrats aren't stopping with the sexual assault allegations. They're now trying to prove that he was just a horrible, awful drunk in high school and college. For instance, back to the New Yorker article I cited earlier, entitled "Democrats Denounce Limits on FBI's Kavanaugh Inquiry as a Farce." Basically, they include in that article one of his classmates at Yale, Chad Luddington, a professor who is a college professor in North Carolina, said he frequently saw Judge Kavanaugh staggering from alcohol consumption during their student years. He said he planned to tell his story to the FBI at its office in Raleigh, North Carolina. In testimony before the Senate, this is going further in an article, quote, "In testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday, Judge Kavanaugh also denied the possibility that he had ever been blackout drunk, a state that implies memory loss despite consciousness. But Mr. Luddington, a former basketball player at Yale, said in a statement that he could unequivocally say that Judge Kavanaugh had not told the truth. He said that Judge Kavanaugh had often become belligerent and aggressive while intoxicated during his first 2 years at Yale. Mr. Luddington recalled one incident in which he said Judge Kavanaugh threw a beer in someone's face, starting a fight that ended with one of our mutual friends in jail." I want to stop and note here, that may or may not be true. There's actually a police report I'm going to get to in a second that discusses this particular incident. But one thing I want to clearly point out is that this does nothing to prove the sexual assault allegations. All that does is that it proves that he drank. It doesn't even prove that he committed perjury because he admitted under oath that he drank, both in high school and in college. So, you know, what they're trying to do with this other than smear his name is beyond me. But then the New York Times came up with this hot lead. Kavanaugh was questioned by police after bar fight in 1985. As an undergrad student at Yale, Brett M. Kavanaugh was involved in an altercation at a local bar during which he was accused of throwing ice on another patron, according to a police report. The incident, which occurred in September 1985 during Mr. Kavanaugh's junior year, resulted in Mr. Kavanaugh and four other men being questioned by the New Haven Police Department. Mr. Kavanaugh was not arrested, but the police report stated that a 20-year-old man accused Mr. Kavanaugh of throwing ice on him for some unknown reason. This is straight from the previous article. His friend saying that they got in a bar fight. He said he threw beer on him. Now we just hear it's ice. He was questioned by police, but he wasn't arrested, which means there probably wasn't really anything to this. Again, he said, and for crying out loud, it's ice. I know liberals don't like ice, but this has nothing to do with the sexual assault allegations, and it certainly does not prove that he committed perjury. This is a big, fat, nothing burger. Continuing with the Kavanaugh's ice-throwing story, Mediaite had an article that points out New York Times admits error in having op-ed writer who bashed Kavanaugh later report on him. They write, quote, a New York Times magazine writer with a byline and article revealing Judge Brett Kavanaugh's rowdy college behavior previously bashed the Supreme Court nominee on Twitter, deeming him a threat to democracy and society. Emily Bazelon helped report the scoop along with Ben Protes in an article published Monday entitled Kavanaugh was questioned by police after bar fight in 1985. The piece recounts an evening during Kavanaugh's junior year at Yale when he became involved in the scuffle, alleging tossing ice at a fellow patron. While the story doesn't bode well for the judge who is already embroiled in sexual allegations, which have prompted an FBI probe into his past, I'm going to stop right there. That's absolutely ridiculous. Going on, quote, Bazelon and an alumna who's lectured at the school received some flack from the Daily Caller over opinionated tweets on Kavanaugh, which were posted last July. In her comments, Bazelon wrote, I strongly disassociate myself from tonight's praise of Brett Kavanaugh with respect. He's a fifth vote for a hard right turn on voting rights and so much more that will harm the democratic process to prevent a more equal society. She then added, those are fundamental values we try to instill in our students. They matter more than collegiality and credentials. So, a spokesperson for the Times admits that this was an error. Their statement in full to Mediaite says, quote, Emily Bazelon is a writer for the New York Times Magazine who occasionally writes op-eds for the opinion section. She is not a news reporter. Her role in the story was to help colleagues in the newsroom gather documents in New Haven, where Emily is based. In retrospect, the editor should have used a newsroom reporter for that assignment. To be clear, the story is straightforward, fact-based, and we fully stand behind it. Well, I'm glad they do, but it really wasn't much of a story because there's no there. So what? He threw ice. He already admitted to drinking. This does not prove that he was blackout drunk. Any contention that I don't see how anyone as an eyewitness could say someone definitively was blackout drunk. How would you know? You wouldn't know. And unfortunately, I can say that from experience, having a struggle with binge drinking when I was in college. I could tell you that even at my most intoxicated, I remembered what happened the night before. So anyway, this is a ridiculous story. Before we listen to excerpts of Julie Swetnick's interview with Kate Snow of NBC News, had to think about her name for a second, I wanted to talk about some background articles that were published this week. One with the Associated Press. entitled Julie Swetnick, a Brett Kavanaugh accuser, has history of legal disputes. This is written by Michael Kunzelman, Michael Breisecker, and Martha Mendoza with the Associated Press. They write, quote, court records reviewed by the Associated Press show Swetnick has been involved in at least six legal cases over the past 25 years, along with lawsuit filed by former employer in November 2000. The cases include a personal injury suit she filed in 1994 against the Washington, D.C. Regional Transit Authority. Her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, told the AP that court cases involving her have no bearing on the credibility of her claims about Kavanaugh. Avenatti said a suit from her ex-employer said the suit from her ex-employer, it was dismissed a month after it was filed, was completely bogus, which is why it was dismissed almost immediately. He told AP that he fully vetted Swetnick before helping her take her claims against Kavanaugh public. He also released a sworn statement by Swetnick in which she says she witnessed Kavanaugh consistently engage in excessive drinking and inappropriate contact of sexual nature with women in the early 1980s. In the statement which was provided to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Swetnick said that she had been sexually assaulted at a party attended by members of Kavanaugh's social circle, but did not accuse him of assaulting her. Two other women have publicly accused Kavanaugh of sexually abusing them. That's actually not correct, because abuse is very specific. One has. The other says he basically flashed her. So anyway, it's maybe straining gnats at that point, but I want to move on with this article. Quote, the lawsuit said that Swetnick in turn accused Web Trends of subjecting her to physically and emotionally threatening and hostile conditions, and that she claimed that she had been sexually harassed by four coworkers. The coworkers denied the allegations, the suit said. The company's officials later determined, the suit said, that Swetnick had provided false information on her employment record application. The suit alleged that she had misrepresented the length of time she worked at a previous employer and falsely claimed that she had earned an undergraduate degree in biology and chemistry from Johns Hopkins University. Her lawyer, Avenatti, said that whether she has a college degree or not does not matter as to whether she is a sexual assault victim. I agree with that. But we're still talking about her credibility. And if she has lied in the past, that speaks to her credibility as a witness. So, you know, that's not information that you can just dismiss. And again, this is not a right-leaning news publication that's publishing this. This is the Associated Press. Then she has an ex-boyfriend who came out and said, Julie Swetnick threatened to kill his unborn child and was exaggerating everything. This is Fox News. The article on their website reads, quote, on the Ingram angle, that's Laura Ingram, Julie Swetnick's ex-boyfriend, Richard Venisi, details why the third Kavanaugh accuser is unreliable. Venisi said Swetnick never mentioned having been so sexually assaulted. The ex-boyfriend of Julie Swetnick, the third woman to make uncorroborated, lurid allegations of a sexual misconduct against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, told Fox News exclusively on Monday that she had threatened to kill his unborn child and at times even bizarrely asked him to hit her. Right after I broke up with her, she basically called me many times, and at one point she basically said, you'll never, ever see your unborn child alive, Richard Venisi said on the Ingram angle. According to Venisi, Swetnick told him at the time, I'm just going to go over there and kill you guys. Swetnick is represented by anti-Trump lawyer Michael Avenatti. He did not immediately respond to Fox News' request for comment on Venisi's allegation, but in an interview on CNN Monday night, he cast doubt on Venisi's credibility and characterized him as an estranged boyfriend. Okay, well, you know, that's fair. It's still, you know, it's he said, she said, so I'm not going to, you know, it wouldn't be fair of me to say that, you know, everything that he's saying is true. Just like it's not fair to say everything she's saying about Judge Kavanaugh is true. Continuing with this article, Venisi, quote, Venisi, who said he dated Swetnick on and off for 7 years, maintained that Swetnick never once mentioned to him her extraordinary claims apparently made for the first time last month that Kavanaugh had engaged in systematic gang rapes decades ago. He said the relationship spanned from 1994 to 2001. Never, never once did she mention that to me, he said. We used to talk about everything. She never once mentioned that at all. If you ask me personally if I believe her, I don't believe her. I really don't believe her. Nobody knows Julie Swetnick better than me. Well, I'm sure there are people who do. But, also another piece of information. Quote, he added, that while he was not aware of Swetnick's political tendencies, she always wanted to be at the center of attention. She was exaggerating everything. Everything that came out of her mouth was just exaggerations. So that's from an ex-boyfriend. And, you know, like Michael Avenatti said, this person could just be totally estranged from her. He could be totally making this up as well. We don't know. But there are questions of credibility that I think are legitimate. And I want to play for you the introduction to Kate Snow's interview. She lists some caveats before they play the interview that I thought were interesting. So take a listen.
Ari, thanks. What we want to do here is lay out all that she said, her story, our reporting. We want to be very transparent because these are very serious allegations. Kavanaugh has called Julie Swetnick's story nonsense and a farce. The president today questioned her credibility, and NBC News, for the record, has not been able to independently verify her claims. There are things that she told us on camera that differ from her written statement last.
So there, she admits there are claims that she made that were different than her written statement. She also says they have been unable to corroborate any of her claims. Interesting.
We've been trying independently to reach out to anyone who remembers attending parties with Julie Swetnick and Brett Kavanaugh, and we've been asking her attorney for names. So far, we've not found anyone who remembers that. She's also unclear about when she first decided to come forward.
So she says she's unclear about when she decided to come forward. Listen to her interview with Kate Snow when she talks about why she decided to come forward. And you decide whether this just, to me, it just seemed really odd. I don't know if it does to you, but it does to me. It just seems off. But go ahead and take a listen.
I'm quite a shy person and quite a private person. And I wouldn't be here today except for about 6 weeks ago. I happened to learn about Brett Kavanaugh becoming one of the people who was shortlisted to go to the Supreme Court.
This is in July? Summer?
I don't remember exactly, but it was about 6 weeks ago. And then I became aware of Dr. Ford and her description of what had happened to her at a party one time that also had Brett Kavanaugh involved. And I started to think back to my days when I was in the early 80s in Montgomery County in Maryland. And I thought that I might have some information that might corroborate some of the things that she had stated.
So you only thought about coming forward when you learned about Dr. Ford?
Yes, because I did not know how close Brett Kavanaugh was to possibly becoming the next Supreme Court justice.
I just want to get the timeline right about this because he was nominated in July. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford came forward in the Washington Post more recently in September. Mm-hmm. So was it in September that you
It's been several weeks, but I'm not somebody who follows the news. I'm not political at all.
Two things that jumped out at me when she was talking. The first was She said she learned about Dr. Ford's allegation several weeks ago. Well, this allegation has only been made public 2 weeks ago. Then she said that she had to think back to her time in the 80s, which, if this is something that, if this is something that truly occurred, you wouldn't think she'd have to search the recesses of her memories to realize, oh, connect Judge Kavanaugh with this. Oh, I went through this experience. Was Brett Kavanaugh there? It just seems kind of weird to me. But then again, I'm not a trauma memory expert. So, you know, you decide. Ultimately, the Senate will have to decide what this is credible. I should note that the to date, anyway, at the time of me recording this, the FBI has still has not committed to actually talking to Mrs. Or Ms. Swetnick. So I think there's probably a good reason for that. There's a lot of credibility issues. She also made something. She also said something very remarkable about her claim that Kavanaugh and Mark Judge would spike the punch at parties.
Did you see Brett Kavanaugh, you know, spiking the punch, putting green alcohol in the punch?
Well, I saw him giving red Solo cups to quite a few girls during that time frame, and there was green punch at those parties. And I would not take one of those glasses from Brett Kavanaugh. I saw him around the punch, I won't say bowls, or the punch containers. I don't know what he did, but I saw him buy them, yes.
So here she admits, and this is a discrepancy between what she said to NBC News and what she said in her statement sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which, by the way, is under the penalty of felony. If you submit basically fraudulent information to Congress in an investigation, that carries with it a penalty of up to 5 years in prison. She says that, well, no, I didn't actually see him, you know, spike the punch. Oh, I didn't actually see him necessarily around the containers. I just saw him handing out red Solo cups. Okay. Does she even know what was in those red Solo cups? No, she doesn't. So, this really puts a hole in her allegation. But there's more.
You're innocent. Well, until what happened to me happened to me, I didn't put two and two together. But I would see boys standing outside of rooms, congregated together, sort of like a gauntlet. And I didn't know what was occurring. But I would see them laughing, a lot of laughing.
Standing in line outside a room?
They would, not line, but definitely huddled by doors. And I didn't understand what it could possibly be.
And in your declaration, you describe Brett Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge standing outside,
yes.
Seeing them stand outside a door.
Yes, with other boys.
So you're suggesting that, in hindsight,
yes,
you think he was involved in this behavior?
I would say yes. It's just too coincidental.
So far, we have established she didn't really see Judge Kavanaugh spike punch, or even be near any punch container, but it handed out red Solo cups to girls. We don't know really what was in the red Solo cups, even though she says grain punch. I think that's punch mixed with grain alcohol was in the, you know, being passed around at the parties. I just have to side note, who drinks grain alcohol? Anyway, moving on. Now she says that she didn't really know what was going on with these, you know, behind these doors, but that she saw Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh hanging around with other boys outside doors. This could have been the freaking door to the bathroom, as far as we know. She's trying to put these pieces back together in hindsight after what happened to her, but we don't. This testimony is just falling apart. I mean, any decent defense attorney would be able to rip this to shreds. This is not credible eyewitness testimony. She doesn't know what was actually going on. She didn't even describe it necessarily as a line. She said it was kind of like a gauntlet. What the heck does that even look like? I have no idea. But you know, listening to this, it's just really odd.
I cannot specifically say that he was one of the ones who assaulted me, but before this happened to me at that party, I saw Brett Kavanaugh there, I saw Mark Judge there, and they were hanging about the area where I started to feel disoriented, and where the room was, and where the other boys were hanging out and laughing. I could hear them laughing and laughing. And it's very hard for me to talk about this, but it's important that somebody says something, because if Brett Kavanaugh was one of those people that did this to me, there is no way in the world that he should go scot-free on this and that he should be on the Supreme Court.
Something may have happened to Julie Swetnick. But listening to her, I listened to the full interview. I didn't want to play the full one because, well, this is NBC News' interview. I just wanted to play excerpts just so you kind of get a feel. You can go to NBCNews.com or MSNBC, and you can find the whole video there and listen to it and actually watch her if you like. Here again, some questions I have. She says she remembers Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge being at the party the night that she was allegedly raped by multiple boys. And she alludes that she said, you know, she insinuates that they may have actually been, you know, among those boys. But she doesn't know. My question is, if she can remember Mark Judge and if she can remember Brett Kavanaugh, does she remember anybody else at this party? Does she know any of the boys that allegedly raped her? Because gang raped obviously means multiple assailants. So, you know, I'm kind of curious. After she discussed this, she did say she told her mother, unfortunately, who's now deceased, so we can't get a corroboration from her mother. She also says she filed a police report. The police officer she spoke with is also deceased, and NBC News put in a request for the police report, and basically Montgomery Police Department said it was going to take a month, so we don't even know if this is actually even true. Maybe it is, but one thing we do know for certain is, let's establish here what she said. She does not know for certain that Brett Kavanaugh basically spiked the punch. She asserts that Brett Kavanaugh was outside a room with other boys. Okay. She says that Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge were at this party when she was raped, but we don't know if they were actually involved. She's trying to tie a lot of connect the dots with something that happened in the early 80s. And folks, especially based on her, this is just so problematic that it's not credible. And so far, the Wall Street Journal has tried to corroborate her claims and have been unable to do so. NBC News has not been able to corroborate her claims. And the FBI doesn't even look like they're even going to take a shot at this. So, you know, this just seems to me that this, again, while it's a serious claim, it's also probably the least plausible of all the accusations made. As David French, in his article that I referenced earlier, stated, you know, if there were gang rape parties going on in the early 80s, that would involve multiple victims, that would involve multiple bystanders, this would have come out, this would be known, there would be corroboration, this would not have been kept secret for decades. So I have a hard time believing this story, especially since she's details what she's telling NBC News does not match the description she gave to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So, I mean, what are we supposed to believe? You know, Judge Kavanaugh and Mark Judge are very clear saying they were not involved. They have no knowledge of this. Right now, she has no corroboration. Maybe something did happen to her. I'm not saying nothing did. But we can't for certain say Judge Kavanaugh had anything to do with it. There's no proof. Finally, to just wrap up here, I wanted to discuss an article in the New York, not the New York Times, excuse me, National Review. It says, poll, Kavanaugh confirmation process hurts McCaskill with voters. This is by Jack Crow. He writes, quote, the heated battle over Judge Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court has hurt vulnerable Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri in her race for re-election, according to a recent poll. The poll conducted by Remington Research Group on Wednesday and Thursday found that 49% of 1,555 likely Missouri voters said that they were less likely to vote for McCaskill after witnessing Kavanaugh's confirmation process, while 42% said they were more likely to vote for her. Notably, 47% of women said the Kavanaugh process had made them less likely to vote for McCaskill compared to 42% who said the opposite. That is, unquote. That's intriguing. Going on, he writes further, a number of the red state Democrats are wrestling with the implications of their vote on Kavanaugh's nomination, including Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. Joe Donnelly of Indiana announced last week that he will not vote to confirm Kavanaugh. Manchin's constituents overwhelmingly support Kavanaugh's confirmation, according to a poll conducted late last week following Kavanaugh's testimony. So this is going to be interesting to watch. I think, and I've contended, that Democrats' conduct and how they handled this, you know, for instance, Senator Feinstein knew of the initial allegation back in late July and held on to it until after the vetting process, until after the meeting. She didn't bring it up meeting with him individually. She didn't bring it up in closed session. She didn't bring it up during the hearings. And right when they were about ready to vote, then she insinuates something that she has something that an allegation has been made, but wouldn't go public with it. And then it leaked mysteriously. And then the press ran with it. This just stinks to high heaven. Even if you believe the allegations, how the Democrats have handled this process is disgusting. And I think they're going to pay a political price for it, at least with some of these Senate races. I think Heidi Heitkamp in particular, she's already trailing in the polls to her Republican challenger. She is going to have a hard time explaining voting no on Kavanaugh if she does vote no. Joe Donnelly, I think, is going to have a hard time explaining why he's voting no on Kavanaugh. These are states that Trump won overwhelmingly. Joe Manchin is still undecided. Also Rick Scott's opponent, or Bill Nelson, the incumbent senator in Florida, who's running against Rick Scott, the current governor of Florida. Nelson said he's a no vote. We're going to see if there's a political price to pay as well. This will be interesting to see. This could potentially stymie any blue wave that occurs, at least in these states. It may actually bolster in other states. I don't know. What we could see, and this would be interesting if it does happen, that the House, that Democrats win back the House. Because I'm looking at polling and looking at even Iowa. I know in Iowa, Congressman Rob Blum is in trouble. I think Congressman David Young is in trouble. These are very tight races, and I think right now they're probably leaning Democrat based on what I've seen with polling I've seen with voter registration numbers. Just this week, it was announced by the Iowa Secretary of State, Iowa 3rd District, for the first time since redistricting in 2012, Democrats now have a voter registration edge. It's only 475 voters, but Republicans in the last two, especially Congressman Young in the last two elections in 2014, 2016, he had a voter registration edge of roughly 11,000 voters. That's gone. That should be concerning to Republicans. But on the flip side, while Democrats might win back the House, it is entirely possible that Republicans actually expand their lead in their majority in the Senate, which would be weird. But, you know, hey, that's American politics for you. We tend to like gridlock, it seems like. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. But, hey, I just want to thank you so much for listening to the podcast. We've come to time to wrap this up. I want to encourage you, if you are listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to go to caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's caffeinated thoughts, CAFFEINATED, caffeinatedthoughts.com, or just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. That way you don't miss a single article that we write, because we don't just podcast, or I don't just podcast, but we also write too. A lot of those thoughts are mine, but also I have other contributors as well. Also, be sure to sign up for emails. That way our articles come straight to you in your inbox. And you can also listen to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on SoundCloud, on Podbean, who am I missing, Google Play, Stitcher. You can listen to us on basically on one of your favorite podcast apps. So, hey, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, take care.